microphone. Well, thank you for the invitation to participate in this retrospective. I'd like to thank Michael and Isabella for this opportunity. It's been an excellent conference. I also just would like to put in a word for the first half of 2008 when we had the program, where special note of thanks to Michael and Isabel and also Alex for organizing that half year. I guess after at the lunch hour we'll be actually telling the organizers how fruitful that session has been for many of us, and for me in particular personally. I mean, I've met a large number of collaborators from that first program. That's very productive for me. Okay, so today I want to talk about one of the projects that came out of that. In fact, I think on the archive, our first paper on this was actually probably there in June of 2008 during the end of the program. But it's been through the proverbial ringer, and it's the most recent version has just, I guess, recently been put up, and I hope it's the final version. So Michael has already told us in the previous hour a broad overview of 2-8 inequalities. So I'd like to concentrate on the one aspect of our joint work, Michael and Matthew and I, and that has to do with P not equal to 2. So I'm going to go over some of the background very rapidly because it's already been covered. So of course there's the 1972 result of Ben Muckenhoop on the maximal function, where he showed it satisfies the weighted norm inequality with one weight and a p between 1 and infinity if and only if W satisfies this AP condition, which we've already seen. So then the next year, after Ben came back from sabbatical, apparently he was working on this a little bit just with Whedon just before he left for sabbatical, and he finished the maximal function there, and when he came back, joined forces with Dick, and they considered the Hilbert transform, and it satisfies the same weighted norm inequality, one weight, if and only if the same condition, the AP condition. And of course, this was related to Helson-Zagel theorem and a bunch of other function theoretic problems. So this was quite a nice result at the time. Still is. So then, as Michael said, in 81, I looked at the two-weight inequality for the maximal function, and you get this testing condition. You can actually further localize the interval on the outside to the cube key. Then, for fractional integrals, this was actually in 86. Satisfies the same two-weight norm inequality, and of course this time, as Michael said, you get not only, because it's a linear operator, not only do you have to test the forward inequality, this one, over cubes, and again there's a slight reduction on the outside, you only have to limit it to the same cube here, but you also have to test the dual inequality. And I think I want to make two comments about the proof. I'm not going to probably write anything down at this stage. But the first is, in all of these problems, you have to localize. You have to somehow, when you're applying an operator to something, and you're looking then far away, there's got to be some way of separating the far awayness and getting rid of that right away. And so concentrate on the stuff that overlaps. And how that was done for fractional integrals was the classical maximum principle. Maybe you should call it quasi-maximum principle, because there's a constant C there, it's not one. But the idea is very simple. So this fractional integral is this kernel that's positive, has a tail. And if you're looking at the part of your measure, F sigma, F is, by the way, non-negative here, that's supported outside of 3Q. So the cube is going to be this little square meter in front of me. We're in Canada, so I'm just using meters for the first time in my life, actually. And outside the triple of this cube is where F sigma sits. So we're taking X in Q. So here you are, you have this big kernel, positive kernel above you, but it's only seeing stuff out there. Now, Q is a Whitney cube for that set where I alpha exceeds lambda. That means that if I go to the edge of the room, I get to a point X that's outside omega lambda, where the fractional integral value is actually equal to or less than lambda, because it's not satisfying that condition you see at the end of the invisible pointer. What happens to the kernel? Remember, the stuff it's acting on is outside 3Q. Now, some of it's over there, some of it's over there. As I move my pole over here with my tent, obviously the kernel's getting much bigger on this stuff. It's getting smaller on that stuff, but not much smaller because it was already outside 3Q. It's only gotten a small amount smaller. So therefore, when I move over here, the values I'm seeing with the kernel has either increased or decreased, not by too much, which means the value over here is not an awful lot smaller than the value here, and that gives you that inequality. So it's a very simple-minded process, but it has great dividends because it tells you that once you're in a Whitney cube, if you want to see where it's even bigger than that lambda, it's only because of what happens within 3Q. It's only the local part that matters. Then, if it's only the local part that matters, well, you do this at every scale K, and of course, the local parts all pile up. They overlap. And this is where you have to have some way of adding them up. How do you get the so-called, quasi-orthogonality of being able to add stuff up? Especially with a positive operator. It sounds like the wrong use of the word. So what you do with the cues is you look at these so-called principal cues. At least this is how it was described by Mockenhoop and Whedon back in the early 70s. So you have some cube where things are starting to pile up, and then you say, well, look at all the children cube that come up in your analysis. Look at the first, and you can go down, and look at they're nested. Look at the first time one of them exceeds twice the average of the one you're starting at. And you call those stopping cubes. This is the standard Kalman-Zygmund stopping time type argument, but related to a specific grid of cubes that comes up in your proof. And then all the cubes that you ignored on the way down, you call them the corona. And of course, that notation comes from Carlson's construction for his proof of the corona theorem, where you had stopping things and you were looking in the upper half space, and the stuff in between looked like a corona. But anyway, so these are these sets we'll call the corona. They're the ones that are not the stopping times. They're the ones in between, and they will play a crucial role in what I want to tell you today. So we'll leave that amount of detail. Let's go back to discussing results. Michael already mentioned the Vidin-Journay that came up a little later in 1984. I'm just pausing to see if anyone's paying attention. Hint. Try not to do this too fast. In 1986, I did this. And a little later in 1984. Anyway, the 86 paper was submitted back in 82 or 83. Didn't take that long. It was hard. Spent a lot of time on it, but it got lost. I sent it to the transactions of the AMS, and after 2 years, I inquired. I hadn't heard anything, and I inquired and discovered that there was a new editor. Peter Jones was the new editor. He'd never heard of it, and he said he'd get back to me. Apparently, it had gotten, in a filing cabinet, got stuck underneath somewhere, and just so it had never been processed. So that's why it came out later. And the date received. Peter put the correct date received on it, though, based on what I told him. Okay, so what they showed is this theorem is a little bit different in nature. It's not two weights. The weight is Lebesgue measure. The idea is, for a Kalman-Zygmund operator, how do you tell if it's bounded on L2 or not? Well, you have these standard size and smoothness conditions, And of course, the classical question is, what do you need in the way of cancellation? Because if there's no cancellation, obviously these things are infinite. And the cancellation used to be like an odd kernel was the simplest one, and then variations of that. And then this theorem simply attacked the problem of, how do you tell? You know, what is it about the kernel that will do it? And it'll tell you whether or not it has enough cancellation. And so their theorem answered the question. So if you have an operator related to a kernel, at least in the sense that a way outside the support of F, where no cancellation can take place, you just work that, then T is bounded on L2 if and only if there's some weak bounded in this property, which is clearly necessary, and then these two testing conditions. Now, because of these size and smoothness conditions, they chose to phrase their testing conditions in this form, T1 and BMO, T star 1 and BMO. I don't think, it was certainly not obvious to me at the time, but later, I learned it from Eve Meyer, but later people realized that, maybe I was the last to know, that T1 and BMO is actually just the testing condition. It's equivalent, given the size and smoothness. You just apply the, anyway, it's an elementary argument, I won't go through it. And same with the T star. So these T1 and BMO, T star 1 and BMO, are just testing conditions. And maybe just a small word about the structure of the T1 proof. How did they do it? Well, they have this operator T, and suppose you have T1 and BMO, T star 1 and BMO. What do you do? Well, first of all, you want to replace the T of 1 and the T star 1, being in BMO, by being equal to 0. First of all, because 0 is a BMO function, it's the simplest case. So what you do is you subtract what you think are simpler operators from T that have the same property, that send 1 to that particular BMO function. These are called paraproducts. So you do that for T and T star. And then you're left with this operator where the T of 1 and the T star 1 are both 0. Such an operator with those conditions is just always bounded on L2. There is no condition, so it always works. So the condition about whether or not it's bounded is encoded in the paraproducts. Paraproduct with symbol T1 and the paraproduct with this. And of course, as you can see then, the answer is encoded in the testing condition. So the cancellation conditions that are required are actually encoded in the testing conditions. That's the lesson, at least in Lebesgue, that's the lesson from David and Journay. Michael also mentioned this result from 2004, which also just appeared on the archive this year, 2010. Volberg lost the paper, some story. But this is really beautiful argument where they assume the pivotal condition, which we've sort of seen already. And then the theorem was that the Hilbert transform satisfies the two-way L2 inequality. And my version, instead of using principal values, you just look at uniform truncations of H. Fix an epsilon, ask for this inequality to hold for H sub epsilon, but then you want the constant uniform of S. And that's even more elementary to define things. And the condition is if and only if. This is this condition that Michael told you about. It's like the AP condition, sorry, the A2 condition. I think of it as the A2 condition on steroids. What you usually have is the average of omega, and then times the average of sigma. Well, instead of the average, you now take, you know, the average plus 1/2 of the next one, plus 1/4 of the next one. That's the plus on integral. So you bulk it up, and you want that still to be fine. And the two testing conditions. So now I want to just mention a couple of things about the diverging methods, diverging in one sense, the method of the NTV versus the method used for fractional integrals, both of which were discussed by Mike earlier. So let me just say the L2 methods, always you have to localize. So David and Journay use Kotler's lemma, which localizes away from the diagonal, and the paraproducts, of course. Nazarov trial and Volberg use these sigma-adapted Haar bases, which are wonderful things, very special, however. They don't seem to generalize that well to other situations. because of the arbitrariness of the measure sigma is important here. And then they did this wonderful argument, which, you know, can't be done justice in any short time, where they have this inner product. You obviously just want to show that this bilinear form in F and C is bounded, but it's a complicated one because there's a sum over all the I's and J's over all the dyadic intervals. You have to be, they can't be in the same grid, and you have to organize them in such a way that you can apply either the A2 condition on steroids or one of the testing conditions. And it's the organization of this that's really tough. Although, it's one of the things I've learned from Michael, you always seek out paraproducts, because after all, that's the big issue. That's what's determining whether the thing works or not. So you always seek out paraproducts and try to arrange for them, and then things work. But in the general case, as Michael had indicated, there's still a lack of off-diagonal control. Doesn't seem to be a way to get it. And so it has to be hypothesized, and it's not a necessary condition to hypothesize. The LP method. Well, the LP theorem that I'm about to show you, that's our version of what to do for T02, has its proof based upon basically the fractional integral type proof I just showed you a minute ago, except that since the operators are no longer positive, you have to perform a Calderon-Zsigmond decomposition on every stopping cube. Have to do it everywhere at once. And then, of course, you have to exploit this through corona decompositions of stopping intervals. I should have mentioned that the analogous proofs in the L2 methods, your corona decompositions are done relative to the pivot limitation. So it's quite different in conception, at least at the start. So what's the theorem? Well, I'm just going to state a special case of the theorem, which looks kind of nice. So we suppose that omega and sigma are positive locally finite Borel measures on Rn, no point masses in common. This is all perfectly general and perfectly wonderful. And then the curtain falls. We assume sigma is doubling. Sigma doubling means that we're back in the world of homogeneous spaces, et cetera, et cetera. However, only for sigma. We're not assuming omega is doubling, but we are assuming sigma is doubling. So, of course, that is considered a serious blow to the method. And I guess most of the rest of the talk, after describing how this result comes about, the rest of the talk is going to be devoted to why the imposition of sigma is necessary for this method. And the short answer is, it was a little bit surprising to me, the short answer is that the Calderon-Zsigmond decomposition with the properties you would like fails for non-doubling, for many non-doubling measures. And that's a bit surprising. Exactly what I mean by fails has to be explained. But that's after we finish just discussing what the positive result is. So first of all, I should have gone a little further. Besides sigma doubling, yeah, I stopped at the beginning. Okay, what's the theorem? The theorem this time is not for the linear operator, the Hilbert transform, but rather maximal truncations of it. And a little bit of a wrinkle, very maximal truncations. So when you're taking away an interval centered around the point X, the usual truncations, you take away an interval centered at X. Well, here we want to allow the interval to wiggle a little bit, not become too eccentric, but it can wiggle like a quarter in each direction. But you still don't get too close to the boundary of the interval you're taking away. Just wiggle a little bit. That makes it a little bit more robust, gives you a better necessary condition, which actually translates back into sufficient. So we have this slightly larger than usual maximal truncation, but still fairly close to the classical situation. And then T sharp is bounded if and only if. So that's the good thing. It is a characterization, but it's the sigma doubling that's really means we haven't solved the problem yet. But anyways, in this case, you get a characterization if and only if four conditions. they're all necessary, and they're all positive. Well, they're necessary. So there's this dual T-sharp interval testing condition. This probably looks strange to you. It looks strange to me. It's not that strange. So let's... if T-sharp were a linear operator, let's just put, it's not, it's the soup of thing, it's sublinear. But if it were a linear operator, what would that inequality say? Well, any sane person would just dualize the thing and put the F on the outside and put the adjoint of the operator applying to the omega. On the left. You'd rewrite the left-hand side like this. Just move the T-sharp over as a dual. And then you see that if this inequality is to hold for all F in LP sigma that are supported on Q, right, just by Helder's inequality or the reverse of it, you get you would get that the soup is that. And then the rest of the inequality would just say that. And of course, that looks like a testing condition where you're simply testing the dual operator on chi q. Looks exactly like the testing condition. So for linear operators, that really is the dual testing condition. That's why I've called it dual T-sharp. Of course, T-sharp is not linear, so you can't do this thing here, which you can still call it the dual linear testing condition. And it's just as effective in applications, because after all, the T-sharp over there is not raised to a power, it's the power 1. So okay, so anyways, that really is a standard dual-looking testing condition. Then the forward testing condition. Well, there's a wrinkle here, too. So the forward testing condition, you just test over, well, you thought chi q. Suddenly we're testing over chi e. Well, the first thing is to point out that, yes, it is annoying that the chi e is there, but it's not on the right-hand side. I mean, if it were on the right-hand side, that would be equivalent to restricted strong type, which would be quite heavy, because after all, if you let this be e, this could be really small, and suddenly you have to have enormous control over that. Here, the control is still the sigma measure of in q, you just have to allow for all e's. At least in one application we have, this is not a limitation. However, from the purist perspective, one wonders, does it have to be there? We don't know. Also, there's a similar consideration for this testing condition here, simply from the point of view that the T-sharp is a positive operator, and it injects basically a unimodular function into this testing condition. And this chi e could be replaced by a unimodular function. But I just mean a function modulus 1. So testing over chi e sigma is the same as testing over, say, g sigma, where g is any function of modulus exactly 1, or even equal to or less than 1. I mean, they're all equivalent. It's just that in this form, it looks a little less mysterious. And then this strengthened AP condition. Again, this is the AP condition on steroids, at least in the real line, and you want this to be uniformly bounded over all intervals Q. Well, if you remember, it said four conditions. If P is equal to or less than 2, we know these three are necessary and sufficient, which is exactly what you expect. If P is bigger than 2, there's a point in the proof where we need this fourth condition. It's also necessary. It's also positive. It's not a horrible condition. In fact, it's another version of AP on steroids. That's not hard to see if you just take the case L equals 0. This notation, IR to the L, that means the L's dyadic parent. So rather than multiplying by 2 to the L, you just take parents up L scales, roughly the same type of thing. It's a little smaller. So this looks like the Poisson integral, except it's the dyadic version of the Poisson integral. If you take just L equals 0, then of course, because the IRs are pairwise disjoint, you can take the p power inside, and you see you get the omega measure times the sigma measure to the power p and then this Lebesgue measure for that. Anyways, you unravel it, use the A2 condition or the AP condition, and you just get the sum of, you just get that.
So I mean, it really is just the AP condition when L is zero.
So it's some sort of, again, a bulked up version of that. Anyway, so there's what I already said. When P is equal to less than 2, you don't need that condition. It's already implied by the AP condition. In general, it appears not to be. You just don't know. Also, the first factor in the strengthened AP condition, you can just replace it by the average. You don't need both. I've already talked about this in advance, but the role of cancellation, that strengthened AP condition, especially in the case of P equals 2, at one point in a function theoretic problem, it was considered very possible that it was the sufficient condition. Remember, in the world of weighted norm inequality, starting in 1970, this AP condition, or the A2 condition, is so wonderful it spoiled everyone. I mean, after all, a difficult inequality should not be characterized by such a simple condition to work with, a product of two averages. You know, monotonicity, all sorts of things are just wonderfully immediate. By the way, monotonicity is not immediate from the testing condition. If you make sigma bigger or smaller, it's not clear that the testing condition is easier or worse without a little bit of effort. So this really spoiled everyone, and even to this day, no one is willing to let go of the A2 condition. So one of the pushes in two-weight norm inequality theory is to say, well, okay, maybe we'll ignore the characterization because after all it's hard and who knows what it'll look like. Hang on to the A2 condition. What can we do to the A2 condition in the way of, you know, feeding it anabolic steroids, making it a little bigger, bulking it up so that it's sufficient? And that continues today to be a very active area of research. So in other words, you hang on to the good condition and see what you have to do to it. So it was reasonable to suspect that it might have worked here. Nazarov showed that it didn't, and the reason really is the fact that this A2 condition on steroids just uses size and smoothness of the kernel and has nothing to do with the main issue of whether or not there's enough cancellation for the testing conditions. Because it actually follows from this inequality. This inequality is where you have F supported, it would even be enough to take it supported in an interval. And here you look at the integral outside, and obviously the action of H on, well, if you separate the two, it has to do just with the kernel. And for the Hilbert transform, it's supposed to be a positive operator, because H, the kernel of H doesn't change sign in this situation. I mean, from one side to the other it does, but it's irrelevant. So it's the pair of testing conditions that encode the cancellation. It's the para product operator's boundedness that's controlling it. A couple of words about the proof to help explain what goes wrong with the when you don't have doubling. So Koichman came up with this maximum principle that applied to maximal truncations of singular integrals, even though they're no longer, remember that argument I gave you by walking over here required the kernel to be positive. Well, for Calderon-Zsigmond operators using size and smoothness, he was able to show that the same sort of maximum principle holds for H sharp. Then we introduced principal cubes, not with respect to special collections, but basically with one fixed grid, just the Calderon-Zsigmond decomposition, but in the dyadic setting. And then the main step in the proof is to perform Calderon-Zsigmond decompositions on all of these stopping cubes simultaneously. So you have to write F is equal to good plus bad on each stopping cube. And the crucial estimate, well, let's go back to remembering. So here's our, okay, so suppose the big cube is the whole room. That's say GTS. It's a rectangle, but anyway, instead it's a square, it's the whole room, GTS. And then we keep dividing it dyadically until we come down to this little meter squared in front of me, and that's one of these GT plus one R's. It's the first time that the average of F with respect to the measure sigma exceeds twice what it was
to the room. First time it more than doubles. Well, for a non-doubling measure, the first time it more than doubles, it could be 50 billion times as big. But if you back up one dyadic parent, it's still small. Otherwise, you would have chosen it as the new stopping interval. So the dyadic parents are the ones that get the nice average from the Calderon-Zsigmond stopping time argument. And then, of course, if sigma is doubling, which we assume, you can recover from that. What you really want is the bounded average on your stopping cube. I mean, obviously, if you have the doubling measure, you just use the fact that it's already at most 2 to the t plus 1 on the parent, and then inside it can go up with most by the doubling constant beyond that. That gives you the boundedness of the good function. Remember in Calderon-Zsigmond theory, you want a good function that's bounded. That's what's good about it. It's bounded by the right numbers. And then what's left over has to have mean 0 and has to be supported on small places. That's the trade-off. Well, in this situation, we now have the good function bounded. There's another property that's hidden in the proof because of the way that proofs are usually constructed of this sort of thing, but it's actually used implicitly. And that's the following property. I call it the equality of expectations. The good function satisfies the following property. Its average on any of the corona intervals, those are the ones that were not selected, the average of the good function on such a thing equals the average of the original function. It's only when you go inside the stopping intervals that suddenly the averages are different, because now it's just a constant average and it's not related to the average of f anymore. But in the corona, the average of g is the same as the average of f for all cubes in the corona. And that, in the two-weight theory, that's a crucial property, and it rears its ugly head when you don't have the doubling condition. If sigma is not doubling, well, what do you do? I mean, you can't use that construction I just showed you, because without the doubling condition, you can't take the average on the stopping cube. It could be 50 billion times. What you can do is you can back up one dyadic parent and say, well, let me take the average there, do the stop there, even though I wasn't supposed to. It's pretty close. Stop there. You at least get a bounded function there. However, what kills you when you do that is, where do you get the equality of expectations if you stop there? Well, you get it on the corona relative to these new places you stopped. So what you have to do is you look at the parents of all the stopping cubes. They can overlap now. I mean, here's this meter here. My parent is out there. I could have another small stopping cube there with its parent. They can intersect infinitely often. They can pile up. You only get this corona equality because you took the average over the parent here. You don't get the corona property for subcubes in here that are still in the corona. See, there's lots of cubes in this dyadic parent that are still in the corona because they're not contained in any stopping cube yet. And you don't have the equality of expectations for them. So you lose that property on a huge collection of cubes. And I said the enemy is that the parents can have unbounded overlaps. And in fact, the following lemma is, I guess, the main thing I want to tell you today. This is the main obstruction. That there is no way to get around it without just coming up with some new approach that does not require either the boundedness of the good function or doesn't require the equality of expectations. One of them, they can't both be true. So there is a doubling measure, it's a simple one, and an f and LP. That's no locally integrable function that simultaneously gives you the good function and the equality of expectations you need. They don't mix. They're incompatible conditions in general. For doubling measures, yes, it's the standard construction. But this lemma shows that there is no hope. So one has to sacrifice one of those two properties or come up with a new idea. Anyway, that seems to be the sticky point. So ideas are welcome. So I wanted to, I guess, 20 minutes, that's good. So
The proof is not hard. The proof is probably best done with a picture. I mean, I'll go through the slides as well. But the picture is very, I think it's convincing. I should let you look at it while I'm trying to draw the picture. I also will forget. So this is the interval 0, 1. And then we just keep dividing it in half toward one end. You probably can't see the final one. So we're going to name these things. What are the JKs? Well, J0 is the whole thing. J1 is that half. J2. So the J's go from 0 to a point out there. And then the intervals I are what's left over. Well, I know what's left over. So this is the I0. This is the I1. 2, etc. So I2 is half of J2. So the idea is going to be, we're going to put a point mass 1, there. So the measure sigma is going to have a point mass here, and then it's going to have a very small measure out here. This is going to be clearly non-doubling, because you have a really small measure here. You look at the dyadic parent, and you've got huge measure, 1. That's the rough idea. And what this is going to do is this is going to allow us to put an F, which is very badly unbounded, especially as you go down here. F gets bigger and bigger, but because the sigma is so small, its averages on the J's stay small and only exceed 2 for the first time on the reds. So the reds will be the stopping intervals. The oranges will be the corona. And the reason for it ultimately will be, I'm just jumping ahead a bit, the ultimate reason is because if you look at any dyadic sub-interval of this, there are only 3 possibilities. It's one of the J's, it's one of the I's, or it's strictly contained in an I. There are no other possibilities for dyadic sub-intervals. And so all I have to show you is that for the F and the sigma that I construct, if you were to normalize, say, the average of F on the big interval to be 1, then I would just have to show you that on every J, the integral, the average is equal to or less than 2, and on every red, it's bigger than 2. Then the reds would be the stopping times, the first time you ever get something bigger than 2, and the J's would be the corona because they're the ones in between. So it's a very simple exercise to do that. So you choose alpha k's times, you know, averages. So the 1 over ik, that's of course a probability measure on ik, then you multiply it by something really small, summable. I just pushed it and nothing happened. I didn't know that. Then you define f. Of course be 1 at the set consisting of 0, and then you define it to be this number beta k over alpha k, where you want the beta k's also to be small, but you want them to be such that the ratio beta k over alpha k is big. You know what, it helps if I just tell you the example. Alpha k is 2 to the minus k. Make it a little smaller by a fixed epsilon to be chosen at the end. So it's basically alpha is 2 to the minus k, and beta to the k is also small, but it's a bit bigger. It's k plus 1 times 2 to the minus k. It's a little bit bigger than alpha. So obviously you get the beta k over alpha k's are big, and they go to infinity because they're k plus 1's. This thing is still finite because it's k plus 1 to the p times 2 to the minus k. And now we get a whole bunch of properties. I guess we just remember this.
get a whole bunch of properties for free. The sigma measure is this 1 plus the sum of the alphas. The F sigma measure is the 1 plus the sum of the betas. So therefore, this is an elementary calculation. You see that the integral over the I's, that's the red cubes, exceeds twice the average over the initial cube or interval. You see that the average over the J's, you just do the work. Let's not go through it. It's at most twice. So that I claim that proves my assertion that the J's are the corona. So let's just take that as given, that the J's are the corona. Oh, and also, of course, F is an LP sigma. That's trivial to hedge. And now is the important point that I already jumped the gun and mentioned. If I is any other dyadic interval, it's strictly contained in a red, and its average is therefore already bigger than 2. So therefore, the corona is just the J's. That's the key point, just the J's. And now if we claim that G must be unbounded if it satisfies the equality of expectations, for a trivial reason. If you look at the average of G over a red cube, well, the idea is that the red cube can be written as precise difference between two J's, J2 and the other J. So this I is this big J minus that other J. And of course, on the J's, you can replace G by F, and then you can put them back together. So it's just saying that the average over the I, over the red cubes of G must be the same as that over F. If they coincide on the J's, they must coincide on the reds, but the red guys go off to infinity. So you're dead. That really ends most of what I wanted to say, 95, 99% of what I wanted to say. There's one last slide to show you that I stuck on there in case there was 15 minutes left. It's only going to take 2 minutes, and then we're going to quit, so don't worry. But the last slide was put there, you know, just as a, you know, because I thought, well, I could speed up the proof, I can add something, because I never know how long it's going to take. This is our LP theorem. We're discouraged that we had to assume sigma is doubling. But this explanation kind of indicates a main enemy of the non-doubling case. We have to get around that somehow. We also have an L2 theorem. Michael alluded to it, but he didn't state it. And that was, at the end of his talk, he mentioned that in our example, to show that the pivotal condition failed. See, it's like a catch-22. Somebody has the best known theorem in the world to date was the Nazarov-Kreil-Volberg theorem from 2004. Using the pivotal condition. It's the best sufficient conditions they had. It included all other known sufficient conditions. So it's the best theorem. And they have this side condition that they had to assume, and they wonder if it's necessary or not. Well, to prove it's not necessary, you have to come up with an example that fails this side condition, pivotal, but also you have to know that it satisfies the 2-8 Norman equality. How are you supposed to know that if their theorem was the best one device for checking it? So you need a better theorem as well. And the better theorem was we replaced the pivotal conditions by something we called energy-like conditions. And we don't have time to go through that. But that proof also came close, as Michael indicated. It still didn't quite capture the off-diagonal decay. So there are basically two methods that we use to try and solve two-weight Norman equalities. One deriving from fractional integral type arguments together with Calder and Zygmund. Those are the ones I've described here. They work for all LP. Incidentally, that's their main advantage. We don't have any competitors for P, not 2. It's the only result in town. But for P equals 2, of course, there's the Nazarov-Kreil-Volberg work, which is done in the dyadic case and very beautiful in the continuous case. And the methods are quite different. I showed you back there about how you use the sigma-adapted Haar functions, etc. Orthogonality when P is 2, and when P is not 2, you have to use something else. Nevertheless, despite the fact that they look so different, this last slide just says the similarities between the L2 and the LP methods, those two different techniques for getting two-weight Norman equalities. Other than, there's a third technique, and that is don't give up on the A2 condition. Hang on to it and see what the best is you can do with it. That's a separate issue. But in terms of trying to get a characterization, these are the two methods. On the left is the Nazarov-Kreil-Volberg method. On the right is the method we use for LP. And there's a lot of buzzwords here that probably haven't been explained.
here, of course, in the NTV world, they look at the bilinear formulation. We just look at the LP norm of H sharp on F. There, in order to get good interaction between F and C, they have to randomly move their grids around. The dyadic grids cannot never be the same or even near each other. Maybe we could have used that. We used something called shifted grids that achieved the same sort of thing. It comes from Michael Criss. I think it comes from Michael Criss' first work. Other people have used it a lot, though. But it sort of does the same thing. Both things have to, in our case, we have cubes and we have these triples, which we have to deal with. Well, the triples are not nested, and we'd like them to be, and so we use shifted dyadic grids to nest them. Here, of course, they break their inner product up as finely as they can according to the hard decompositions. Here, we just use the sort of the obvious thing and the Whitney decompositions of open sets and the usual discretization of an interval. Then over here, when the I's and J's are far apart, they call that long-range terms. That corresponds to our maximum bits. There's a one-to-one correspondence between the types of terms that are estimated. Here we use the Zuccoli-Run-Zygmund decomposition to get estimates having to do with exploiting the smoothness, size and smoothness of the kernels. On this side, I'm giving you our version of NTV. When we translated their argument, we get something called an energy lemma. Sort of kind of does the same thing. Over here, there's principal cubes used. They're the same as the stopping intervals, although what you stop according to is different. Here it's averages, there it's pivotal conditions. In both sides, you get Perona and testing. Dyadic parents play a big role on both sides. And of course, para products play a huge role in this bilinear one. And the closest thing here is the Poisson inequality. So there's a lot of similarities, even though the methods are quite different. And I think it would be nice to understand this better. What's really different? What's really the same? So, anyways, open problems. Well, they're both open. So, thank you for paying attention.